From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at how increasing Wisconsin's minimum wage would affect workers, especially women and people of color. Then State Representative David Bowen talks about the bias black men face based on their clothing.
It doesn't matter what you wear, how you talk, where you're from. This skin is what gets you killed.
We'll tell you about a new Milwaukee podcast that shares stories from currently and formerly incarcerated people.
Showing the stories of those inside who really get it, who really have changed their lives, who really are no longer at all what they went in as, is a huge way of correcting the narrative about people with criminal records and correcting the narrative about the need for reform.
Plus, we'll hear about an art exhibit that combines the writings of trauma survivors with landscape paintings. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. President Biden has renewed the fight for a higher federal minimum wage. Currently, it stands at just $7.25. The president wants to more than double it to $15. Although the fight for 15 is nearly a decade old, there isn't a single state with a minimum wage that high. And while the majority of states do have a minimum higher than the federal standard, Wisconsin is not among them. So what could a higher minimum wage mean for Wisconsinites? Laura Dresser has been crunching the numbers for her organization COWS, a think tank based at UW-Madison. She joins me now to talk about the fact sheet they recently released on this issue. Laura, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
How many people would be directly impacted by raising the minimum wage? And by that, I mean, how many workers would see an increase in their pay?
The proposal at the federal level is to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025. Currently in the state of Wisconsin, it's $7.25 an hour. So that's a long way to go up. And that increase directly affects all the workers who are under $15 an hour, and that's almost 600,000 workers. But it also indirectly affects another 250,000 workers who work close to that $15 an hour, but above it. And so in whole, about 840,000 workers would see their wages go up as a result of that increase, or 3 in 10 of the total workforce in the state of Wisconsin see wages go up if we moved on that federal proposal.
That is a lot of people. And when we talk about, you know, who's actually getting this money, who is being directly impacted by the wage increase, there's this misperception that minimum wage workers are disproportionately kids, teenagers. What does the reality look like in Wisconsin? Who is working at these low wages?
I mean, I think it's really easy for policymakers or people who have made it in some way or another. They look back and say, I had a job like that once. I worked at the minimum wage once, and it was a temporary short-term status. But we know for many workers, low-wage jobs are kind of lifetime jobs. And there are a lot of workers in that range from $7.25 to $15 an hour that are working their entire careers in food service and childcare and nursing homes, small manufacturing shops, working their entire careers at less than $15 an hour. And I think the bulk of the workers who stand to gain are actually adults, not teenagers.
Your fact sheet also looked at how raising these wages would impact gender and racial equity here in Wisconsin. Can you unpack that a bit?
You know, we think of this as a universal policy. It affects all workers equally, right? But it affects the workers closer to the floor more. So we know that the workers who have the lowest wages are the workers that face disadvantages of race, gender, ethnicity, immigration status. And so those workers stand the most to gain because they feel the impact of the increase more. It closes the gap between those workers in the middle because it moves the floor closer to the middle of the labor market. So while it moves wages for 3 in 10 Wisconsin workers, it moves wages up for half of Hispanic workers and half of Black workers in the state, and 37% of women, because those are the workers who work closer to the floor. So a higher floor raises them closer to the middle.
Putting aside for a moment the direct impact on Wisconsin, you also looked at how our minimum wage here in Wisconsin compares to other states. How do we stack up?
Well, there's just 21 states right now of the 50 are using the federal minimum wage as their minimum wage, basically. 29 states have taken the choice to proactively increase the minimum wage. This $7.25 was set in 2009. And every year, inflation makes that less relevant to the cost of living. So over the past decade, 29 states have taken on, you know, raising their wages above the federal floor. Our neighbors, Minnesota and Illinois, are well above the floor. I think sometimes people think of this as only a coastal thing that, you know, liberal states do. And it's true. The West Coast and a lot of states on the East Coast have higher minimum wages. But also, anytime you put this on a ballot, the state of Florida on the federal election in November passed a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. It's very popular in conservative and liberal states. So you can find much higher minimum wages all across the country, but not in Wisconsin.
It was surprising to see some of the states that have higher minimum wages than Wisconsin, states that I think of as being much more conservative and much more in favor of business interests, especially a place like South Dakota, West Virginia. When it comes to our neighboring states, Minnesota, Illinois, what does their minimum wage look like compared to ours?
The minimum wage in Minnesota right now is just over $10 an hour. It's actually $10.08. It gets indexed to inflation, and so it makes it these strange numbers like $10.08. And Illinois is right now at $11 an hour and moving towards a much higher threshold. Both of those will have annual increases. And that means, in fact, that workers near our borders probably find work, especially in the low-wage jobs, on the other side of the border, much more interesting than work in the state of Wisconsin. So it would be better to move the federal floor altogether. That helps keep the equity across the borders and helps, you know, keep the competition between employers more fair in terms of the wage role in that. But right now, Minnesota and Illinois are well above Wisconsin and on their way to being even more above.
Speaking of competition, when we talk about raising the minimum wage, there are a lot of arguments against it. And one of the biggest ones come from business owners who are understandably worried that raising the minimum wage would ultimately hurt them. And right now, when we have so many businesses that are hurting because of the pandemic, this becomes even more concerning. What has that reality looked like in other states? We have a lot of examples.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we've really seen over the last decade is this much more aggressive labor floor raising, especially given the context of the fight for 15. I mean, the idea of moving the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour was simply not on anyone's screen before fast food workers in 2012 went on strike for $15 and a union and sparked this movement from there. And because of all that innovation, I think you can see in all the different ways cities and states have moved aggressively on wages. I think there's a lot of experience about what it means in terms of competitiveness and business strategy. And I think one of the things that's really clear to me is that imagining what's going to happen when you face a raise, I think most employers, like you mentioned, most business owners feel quite fearful about that. It seems like a cost pressure that how could they possibly deal with that with a small margin? But when everybody has to deal with that same cost pressure, I mean, they're imagining I have to raise my wage costs and nobody else does. But in fact, everybody who pays the same wages as you do, right? So that's one thing that happens. And then I think the other thing is that workers' lives become more stable. And many of these low-wage employers end up with lower turnover rates, lower labor replacement rates. And so that there are unpredictable benefits to the wage increases that they don't really see, and a lot of fear. And this is the reason that as you look at states that have increased the minimum wages, you see very healthy labor markets, very healthy retail and food service sectors, even though you see the wages going up. And so businesses there find a way to deal with it, and workers end up with life that is not easy, but much more possible than it is at $7.25 an hour.
You might be able to go out to eat more if you're getting more money.
Yeah, there's a way it ripples through the economy too, right? Workers have a little more money to spend locally. They're, you know, more able to buy more things too. And so you're sort of, you know, the Henry Ford idea or whatever, you know, you want to make workers who can buy the goods you're providing. Raising the minimum wage helps create that as well.
Do you see a path toward a $15 minimum wage by 2025 here in the state of Wisconsin, regardless of what's happening at the national level?
I mean, I don't think anybody looking at this kind of the tensions in our state politics would predict that. And I'm not that naive. I do think there's a few things that I try and keep in mind. One is that this is really popular policy with conservatives and liberals, that while the legislature, conservative legislators are unlikely to pass this kind of policy, it is true that if you put it on a ballot in Missouri or Florida, conservative voters support it because people see that having a stronger wage floor would help communities work better. And so I think that this is popular as a kind of solace to me, a kind of inspiration, and the organizing and activism of workers across the state. I think we are often surprised by what is possible. And so I hope to be surprised by this.
Laura Dresser is an assistant clinical professor at the School of Social Work at UW-Madison. She's also the associate director of COWS, a think tank based at the university. COWS recently released a fact sheet on raising the minimum wage here in Wisconsin. And you can find a link to it at WUWM.com. Once again, viral videos are raising questions about how police officers treat Black men. One of the latest videos shows a police officer in Virginia pepper spraying a Black Latino man and forcing him to the ground. The man, an active member of the U.S. Army, was in uniform at the time. But whether it's a military uniform or a hoodie, the incident shows that biases remain, regardless of how a person of color is dressed. Last summer, a group of young Black elected officials got together to change this narrative about Black men, showcasing themselves in both casual and work clothes. Wisconsin Democratic State Representative David Bowen took part in the video, and he spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis about the project and police use of force against people of color.
I always go back to the videos where I see white people use weapons against the police, run from the police, you know, cuss out the police, you know, do all type of disrespectful things, and even use weapons, and they live. And then I get pushback from people here in the state of Wisconsin in the state legislature that say, David, we can't agree to changing some of these laws and some of these policies because that's just too much. It is a system that allows white folks to do the exact same thing and worse and still live. And Black folks that, especially in that video in Virginia, where the man is being very respectful, he's trying to see what's going on. And there's so much of a level of aggression that is, you know, unequal to how the person is even reacting. That clearly makes it clear that this is, it's not about respectability. If it was, we'd be alive. If it was, Black folks would live through those situations just as much as white folks do. It doesn't matter what you wear, how you talk, where you're from. This skin is what gets you killed. And there is a system that defends the people that kill people with this skin. And that system doesn't deserve to exist anymore.
But even with that statement you just made, you are working to challenge the narratives about Black men. I mean, you participated in an Instagram video last summer where you and other young Black men, who also happens to be elected officials, showed yourself first in sweats with Skittles as a nod to Trayvon Martin, and then in your work attire, suits.
Exactly, exactly. Trayvon Martin wore a hoodie. And George Zimmerman, in that situation, targeted him because he felt like this Black boy did not deserve to exist in this white space with a hoodie on, with this stereotypical look that he was out of place. And it's just very clear that, like, when we put on suits as young elected officials and we go to work every day, we are no different than being able to take our jacket off and throw a hoodie on and end up in a situation where we're targeted in the exact same way. In the case of this lieutenant, this army lieutenant in Virginia, with his military uniform on, your uniform can't save you. Being nice can't save you. And then even in situations where you get in trouble or you do the wrong thing, you deserve to have your chance in court, not a police officer be judge, jury, and prosecution and executioner.
Now, we were just talking about the case in Virginia where the man at the center of that police stop has now filed a lawsuit. But we're also on the heels of a police officer in Minnesota killing another Black man during a traffic stop, though this shooting is being called accidental. You know, this is not a new concern for Black and brown people. Why do you think the issue is still so prevalent?
Out of all the issues I've ever worked on as an elected official, this is the toughest one. The lack of progress that we've made from the very first time I was elected on the Milwaukee County Board, and we had a situation of a Black woman who was handcuffed in the back of a Milwaukee police car, and she was punched repeatedly by an officer. And this same officer was lost his job and then appealed to get it back from the Fire Police Commission. And then fast forward, you had Dontre Hamilton killed in 2014, and to, you know, have these repeated situations pop up time and time again. Then Seville Smith, I end up going to the state. Seville Smith is killed in 2016. You have an unrest that is sparked from that in the Sherman Park neighborhood, same neighborhood I grew up. This issue hits so close to home, and you cannot shake the feeling, especially when you fight to change it, and then you become a target. You become the person that is demonized for believing that we have the capacity, the empathy, the boldness to do something about this issue so that Black folks can be alive, so that Black men can be treated with the dignity that they deserve, so that Black women can be protected. It's like you're asking for too much. And I get a chance to hug the parents and the family members of those who have lost loved ones to very preventable situations just like this. It means something for me to know that I have to see this through, that no matter what the cost is, what it takes, even if it costs me my position, because demanding change on this issue is for some people too much, I'm willing to take it that far. I'm willing to go to that distance because we deserve that change. The future that we know that we deserve, a Wisconsin that is more accountable, a Milwaukee that has more equity, a country that realizes that they are stronger and better because they let go of having to put their knee on our necks, having to shoot us in the back 7 times. In situations where a lot of times that we either do the exact same thing white people do and they survive and they get a chance to see their day in court, rather than making the excuses that it's just too much to ask for, you know, that we should have communities that need to live in fear, that criminalization rather than investment is the only thing that we deserve in our neighborhoods, in our communities. is something that, you know, I think me and the other young elected officials that are participating in that video, that is the number one thing on our mind. And we will not let it go until we get that change.
I'm sure you could come up with a number of examples, but could you just give me one specific example of the wrong you see in the system?
The decision not to charge the officer from the Jacob Blake shooting happened, and I put out my press release and I said, if these are the laws that allow this to happen, it's time to change those laws. And then I get opposition in Madison from lawmakers who don't want to take this issue seriously, who want to placate as if they care, but they know that they are protecting a status quo that allows Black people in the state that is the worst for the raise of Black family, that allows us to be killed with impunity. We don't allow people in the community to commit crime and to take lives without being held accountable. It's not going to fly. It's not going to fly with this current generation. It's not going to fly with the new crop of leaders that will not accept that.
Now, earlier you mentioned Sherman Park and the police killing of Seville Smith back in 2016. If I remember correctly, there were a lot of promises made after that uprising about investment in the community and such. I don't think any of that ever panned out. What do you think happened?
You really see how strong the wall of white supremacy is built when you attempt to pull out a hammer and you start chipping away. And then, you know, you see how big that wall is, how thick that wall is. And maybe you don't really need a hammer. You might need a sledgehammer. You might need a jackhammer. You might need a bulldozer, because this thing is built very well and very sturdy. And I see all of my colleagues across the country that are relentless at this point in everything that we do to ensure that we tear this wall down.
This wall of white supremacy, as you call it, is that why you say this is the hardest issue you've worked on as an elected official?
Absolutely. And it's exploited. It is especially used to undermine progress that the community needs, and to get us to settle for, you know, crumbs, get us to settle for whatever, not to actually get the real goal done of real policy change, of real accountability, where if an officer makes those decisions, they will see the same fate that somebody who is in the community and engages in criminal activity. You know, this a lot of times is pitted against, you know, these narratives that these are Black criminals and Black high crime neighborhoods that are expendable, that nobody should defend. And I think one of the biggest things that we push back against every day is the fact that, you know, no matter what somebody has done, their life matters too. You know, you can't have a perfect victim in fighting for this issue, because they might make it seem like this person, because of all the bad things that they've done, that's what put them in the predicament that they were in. And it just happens in those cases to those people. And if you be good enough, if you wear a suit more enough, if you act respectful and nice enough, you'll be okay. You won't end up in that predicament. But that's completely far from the truth.
Representative David Bowen is a member of the Wisconsin State Assembly, representing District 10. He spoke to WUWM's Latoya Dennis about his work on a viral video that challenged biases around the way Black men dress. Right now, we're in the middle of our spring member drive here at WUWM. And I have a feeling, since you're listening, you support your community. You support our work. And you want to see it continue. You can make all of that happen right now by calling 877-583-0309 or heading to wuwm.com/give, or by pressing that big red donate button in the WUWM app. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about an art exhibit that explores trauma through writing, painting, and videography. But first, we'll hear about a new podcast based right here in Milwaukee that hopes to improve collaboration in reentry, reform, and decarceration work. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Shannon Ross got out of prison a little over 6 months ago after serving a 17-year sentence. But he didn't wait for his release to start reforming the system he was already entangled in. Working from the inside, he started an organization called The Community. It helps prepare incarcerated people for reentry and change the narrative about people with criminal records. Now he's continuing that work with a different organization and through a new medium. Ross is a fellow with the Wisconsin Decarceration Platform, and his new podcast, All in Wisconsin, explores ideas and stories about reentry, reform, and decarceration. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi spoke with Ross about the new podcast.
Where did the idea come from for your new podcast?
I don't even really remember when the idea popped up. I just know that we were in a meeting for the Wisconsin Decarceration Platform, which is what is, I guess, the resource behind this even being created. And I just made a comment about, you know, doing a podcast, and somebody has said that they had been thinking about that as well. It made complete sense with things that I feel are not spoken about in the space of reentry reform, decarceration, and ways that we could kind of use this as a medium to increase collaboration and communication amongst organizations doing this work in the state.
So I listened to the first episode, and you talk about the need for collaboration rather than competition in this sphere of reentry, decarceration, reform. What experiences did you have that informed your understanding of this need?
Yeah, so I would have, a pretty expert experience. I spent 17 years in the Wisconsin prison system. From the age of 19 to 36, I was released just over 6 months ago. And I was involved in almost every facet of the prison system that you could be involved in: the education side, the athletic side, the job side, the program side. So I saw a lot of aspects of it, and it gives me an understanding of things that are not well known or important to touch upon. And then also just ways to emphasize the need for not only collaboration and communication amongst the groups out here doing this work, but the need to really communicate with those inside about what's going on, because we lose hope very quickly inside and not being aware of what's really going on and the resources and the opportunities out here. So having people know that before they get out is a really big step for reentry. I consider it pre-entry for the organization that I started when I was inside the community. And I think that is the thing that we don't focus on as much, and it needs to be focused on more, if not more than the reentry side, because you should be coming out with a lot of these things instead of starting to get them when you get out.
Walking out of the prison without any tools or resources in hand is not really preparing someone for reentry.
Yeah, and the self-esteem, like, that's the main thing, is that it's not so much the opportunities as it is the confidence that you can take advantage of an opportunity, that you are, you know, able to do what's necessary for a job, have work ethic, to succeed, to find a family, all those things. And that's what we overlook how important that self-esteem factor is when people come.
So what did it look like for you coming out just over 6 months ago? How were you able to ease that transition? Or was it still rough for you?
No, yeah, it wasn't rough at all. And that's kind of speaks to things that I was able to take advantage of when I was in still. Support and just a general mental infrastructure that I had going in that's not common. And I don't take any pride in saying that I have it, because I didn't ask for it. It was just, you know, for whatever reason, I was able to go into that experience with a level of resilience to see what I could acquire from that experience, right? Incarceration sucks, but there's also a lot of great lessons in hardship. And if you're able to take those lessons and apply them forward, they're, you know, they're diamond, they're gold. So for me, being inside, having people who were willing to help with education and to help make connections and to help find information for me was enormous. And that's what allowed me to get out a lot more comfortable. I also spent my time very much fighting against being institutionalized. So if you can be uncomfortable while you're inside, that will allow you to be comfortable when you get back out. But a lot of times the system incentivizes us to get comfortable while we're in, so that when we get out, we're uncomfortable. And then we have to find our way back into society. And some of us never do.
So thinking about the podcast as kind of a bridge between the world inside prisons and the rest of society, what are some of the challenges of doing a podcast about and with people that are in these different worlds? And how do you kind of bridge those two worlds?
So the idea behind it is that we can tell stories of people that are inside. There are a lot of successful people inside right now, people that are doing things that I think are more laudatory than people that I know that I've known my whole life that never went to prison. So, and I say that not judgingly, just saying that people who are inside are really striving to try and be helpful and try and be a benefit to their community. And there's just a lot of people out here that are just kind of tripping every day through life, and having that experience in prison as an odd way of giving you perspective to be better when you get outside to handle these kind of situations that exist out here. And so showing the stories of those inside who really get it, who really have changed their lives, who really are no longer at all what they went in as, is a huge way of correcting the narrative about people with criminal records and correcting the narrative about the need for reform and a better focus on reentry and what we can do to improve that. And so we can get those stories out to the public via this podcast. By two of the episodes we have coming up are from individuals that are incarcerated. They're both really spectacular examples of what can happen when your people inside are able to take advantage of resources and are given opportunities or have the mental, again, infrastructure to really digest that experience in a way that can move them forward. So we take that and we get that out to the people. And then we also provide a context. You know, sometimes when listeners are hearing about something that they're not really familiar with, they need a context as well to know how this fits into their life, why it's important, and why it also is something that they can actually get involved in ways they're not even aware of. It doesn't take a lot of their time. It doesn't even necessarily take a lot of their money or their resources. It's just something that if they were aware of it and ways to get involved, which we can help, show that, it would increase just a lot of involvement from the community. So that's kind of how we connect what's going on inside with those on the outside that may not know or do know. Again, a lot of the groups that are really doing this work, they need to hear these stories as well, because I think sometimes they lose sight of that and they lose the urgency because they're not as connected to those inside.
Other than groups that are already working in this field, who are you trying to reach for your audience, and what impact do you want these stories to have on them?
So it's kind of an ecosystem, right? Everybody has a place that they fit that can help leverage what the others are doing to all together be more effective in a group. And so we're trying to find this niche. And I think our niche where we really exist at is not so much reaching out to people who are what I call beyond the choir, people that don't really know the system so much. We have parts of what we're going to be doing that really, you know, hopefully have value for them to show them what's going on inside and the stories from people inside and pushing the successes, humanity, and agency of people that have criminal records. So there are definitely parts for them. Where I see us fitting in really well is being like an insider voice, right? We can talk amongst groups. We can be of value to groups that are already doing this work to show them where there are need for collaboration, where there is ways to do it more easier than you think. National interest, like in our first episode, we have Scott Budnick talking about the national interest coming. So kind of spurs groups to essentially maybe say, okay, let's work together a bit more. We have a lot of money and interest coming from the outside. We want to be able to give them something that they can really fuel and even be more effective than these different silos that are hard to fuel individually. So I see that as really our space, is where we can really focus more on the groups that are doing this work right now, the legislators that are doing this work, the supporters and loved ones who are already involved, and show them ways and give them inspiration to work together more, reach out more, and just increase our strength together.
So why right now for this podcast?
So we need to take advantage of right now this interest in society and this issue, this openness in society and this issue in businesses. There's the openness for DEI, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I hear people talking, I hear people with the abolition term being used more and more accepted. And transformative justice is another one that's coming up that's being more accepted and is being looked at. And we assume that because society's interested, that the arc of, you know, effectiveness and justice is on our side with this, but it could easily just go another way. It's all about execution. It's all about how we take advantage of the momentum and the societal interest and respectably and humbly get them to see areas of this that they haven't before and get them to see where they can get involved in a way that fits into their lives and into their values, but doesn't make them feel they're going against their community or, you know, their religion or their political ideology. So, and that's all very doable. It's just, we have to be effective at finding ways to give the messaging to different groups of people instead of always just yelling. We do a lot of yelling in this space and a lot of posting on social media as if everything's very easy to package and you should just catch on and jump on the ship, but we don't do enough listening. And so it's not that simple to always say, hey, I know what's right. I've experienced this. Even from my side, I was in the system for 17 years. I know it's crap. I know that it's incredibly ineffective, destructive. I know it ruins more than it builds, but that's not going to get you to listen to me. Getting you to listen to me is me listening to you first. And so we're really trying to show people what we can and what we know, but at the same time, create a dialogue where you let us know why it is that you're resistant to this. Maybe we're missing something as well. And that is the moment that we're in that we can take advantage of. What I want from the podcast is to spur that conversation, to spur that interest, and in a way to make people who are usually, for one, not necessarily always open to this or are, but don't really know how they can get involved, to have a touch point, have maybe something or somewhere they can connect with and say, okay, let me connect with them. They seem to be matching where I'm, you know, kind of at. I have some fears and doubts, and they're open to that. They're not trying to yell at me. They're not trying to shame me. They're open to how, you know, I can maybe get involved. Maybe we can connect them to somebody else. Maybe it's, you know, the Wisconsin Incarceration Platform or the community, the organization I run. But if nothing else, there's still within the group as a whole that we are trying to speak to so much that we miss and so much that we don't really work together on, that this is an important time that we need to take advantage of in society. And that execution message is huge for us in the group. We know it's crap, but we also need to realize that just because people are listening, just because people are open to it, just because we feel confident in what we're doing, that doesn't mean it's going to work out. We need to work together better. We're not a very well-resourced group. This isn't a field that has tons of money in it. We're asking for money. We're dealing with grants. We're dealing with donors. So we need to find ways to leverage that and find areas where we have commonality, but we don't have a consistency. We don't have a collaboration. We have more of a competition. And can we get over that? Can we work together? Can we kind of meld our interests and be better at the things we've been doing? Because we have to do more than just be on the right side of the issue to be effective.
Shannon Ross is a community fellow with the Wisconsin Decarceration Platform and the president of The Community, an organization that prepares incarcerated people for reentry. Ross is also the creator of the new podcast, All in Wisconsin. You can find a link to it at WUWM.com. And while you're there, you can donate to WUWM for our spring member drive. We know you value these kinds of conversations, not just about the issues that impact Milwaukee, but the Milwaukeeans who are impacted by them. The public radio experience and WUWM transports us to a space that helps us reflect and better understand our community. Please donate now to keep eye-opening radio alive. Call 877-583-0309. That is 877-583-0309. Or head to wuwm.com/give. Coming up, we'll learn about an exhibit transforming trauma into art. We'll have more on the Rise and Thrive Alives in Landscape exhibit next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Living with trauma and injustice is undoubtedly difficult. People deal with and overcome these experiences in different ways. Many find solace through art and writing. That's what the exhibit Rise and Thrive, Alives in Landscape series is all about. The exhibit combines survivor stories with landscape paintings. Visual artist Brianna Seipel collaborated with the Thriver writers to create landscapes inspired by each essay. Seipel, along with self-proclaimed Thriver and public speaker Lisa McCormick, as well as Kate Knowlton, the interim executive director of Lotus Legal Clinic, all joined Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel last November to talk about the exhibit, You'll hear from Seiple first.
I've been working with Lotus Legal Clinic in a variety of ways for the last about 6 years. And I had this idea, my personal work is about exploring our connection to the outdoors and the power of wild spaces to heal, inspire, and transform our lives. So I'm really interested in how landscapes shape our identity and how we can explore our personal stories through art. And so I approached Lotus last year with this idea to say, what would it be like if I worked with alumni of their creative writing program to reapproach their stories in a new light? And that would be one of stories of healing and transformation through this lens of the outdoors. So Lotus said yes to that idea, and I worked with 6 participants last year. They all chose a landscape that was personally meaningful, and then they wrote a story to go along with that. And then in return, I create an oil painting of that place in the natural world, and they receive that as a gift with no cost to them other than their time participating in the project. One of the things that a participant said last year, and it captured exactly what we were going for, is she said that these paintings are a tangible representation of who we are as thrivers on this journey from victim to survivor to thriver. And it's, you know, all of us go through experiences that we have to, you know, we share with others and we heal over time. And it was just a really beautiful metaphor, and exactly what we were hoping that this project would accomplish is really honoring the stories of remarkable human beings through the places that inspire them.
And Lisa, are you participating in this year's show? So can you tell me a little bit about your contribution to this show?
It was an interesting process for us to pick a photo that we had taken. And so I had chosen a photo from a trip we went down to Mexico with my family. And my son absolutely loves to take photos of sunrises and sunsets. And we were on the wrong side of the island or the wrong side of the country to do sunsets. And so we got up really early one morning and began taking sunrise photos. And it was right after a big storm the night before. And so the waves were just crashing like crazy. But, you know, my focus at the time was on the sunrise, not on the water. And until I started this project and really looked at the photo, was a really amazing experience. And then to start putting metaphors to it was really eye-opening. I mean, it was really a cool experience.
And Kate, can you tell me a little bit about Lotus, the organization, for those that don't know or are unfamiliar with it?
Lotus is a legal clinic, so Lotus Legal Clinic. But the uniqueness of us as a legal clinic is that we provide, all of our services are free of charge. And we provide direct representation to survivors of human trafficking, sexual violence, gender violence, and victim of crime. So along with that, we work heavily on the legal end of civil issues that otherwise might be overlooked, just because the way that our criminal system is designed in assisting victims is through the prosecution of their perpetrator. That's incredibly important. It's also completely grinding. It's super hard for prosecutors. It's definitely hard for their victim witness advocates and specialists, but it is really, really horrifically bad for survivors and victims. And it's narrow. So what Lotus tries to do is go in and not only make sure and support all the rights inside of that process, but also identify other civil legal assistance that we can provide on an expert level. So the beautiful part about Lotus is, in addition to those legal expertise, is we also have a survivor empowerment pillar. Stepping outside of the legal processes and the civil representation we can do, Lotus is unique in being able to also provide those empowerment opportunities.
One really good example of that is that Lotus often takes the writing and the artwork created in their Untold Stories program to the Wisconsin State Capitol for Crime Victims Rights Week. And oftentimes survivors will accompany that artwork and speak in the Capitol Rotunda. So that's just an example of some of the platforms that Lotus provides. Their survivor empowerment programs and taking these stories to the public are really about creating empathy and awareness one story at a time. And all of Lotus's programs are trauma-informed, so they have really this beautiful blend of acknowledging pain, but then creating something beautiful from it as well, and providing this platform to tell your story in an empowering way, because you choose how it's told and where it's told.
There's a clear empowerment message throughout Lotus, throughout Rise and Thrive. And so I wanted to ask, what is a thriver? And Lisa, for you in particular, how has your experience with these programs affected you, changed your life?
Well, I guess a thriver is a person who is more than a survivor. You have, I guess I look at it as you sometimes are labeled as a victim first, you know, as a person who's been through something horrific. In my situation, my son Jeffrey was sex trafficked. And so as myself, it was what I went through as a parent of a child who'd been trafficked. But I also am a wife of a, or was a wife of a man who was very verbally abusive. And so I think for a long time, I was a victim of that. And I didn't see myself as a survivor until many, many years later. I think I'm finally just starting to even feel as a survivor. But then when I went to this workshop, I learned about the word thriver. And I learned about that there's more than just surviving and just sometimes just being upright. There's a lot more to that. Being part of this project and hearing stories of these other women who have been through, you know, some incredible things as well. It's a family. It's a network of people who I never probably would have met. I think a lot of my journey, I felt alone and didn't know other people went through this. You're now with a network of people who understand and know it's someone you can speak with and talk with and understand the journey with.
What is the process like to create the piece of writing, to choose an image and bring these two things to life together?
Well, I'll speak on the writing part and Brianna can talk on the art side of it. But for me, I'm a new writer. I'm not a experienced writer like some of these other people I've met on this journey so far, but it really was fun. Like I said, putting metaphors to a picture was a very new experience, and being able to descriptively write was a lot of fun. It was really kind of cool to write about it. And then we'd have in this virtual world, we'd all come together and read our readings together in a forum. And then everyone would have an opportunity to say, well, I like this part, I don't like this part. And we'd kind of feed off each other. And it was really cool because there's a part in my writing where I talk about the ombre colors of the ocean. So from the navy blues to the turquoises to the clear waters. And, you know, to me, I'm just describing the water. And then somebody in the group said, well, you know, colors represent the healing. So the deep, dark navy blue is depression and sadness and grief. And as it turns to a lighter color to almost clear, that's healing. And the clear colors show how you've come through this and you are thriving and you are, you know, so it kind of in the colors alone that describes your healing process. And I was just blown away. I'd never thought of that before. And I talked about waves crashing, like the difficulties in your life as the waves came crashing against my legs and knocking me over, or the water spraying in my face. To me, it was like what I was going through with my son, you know, and the difficulties would come and knock me over. And sometimes they'd, you know, startle me and scare me so much, you know. And so that's kind of the things I was looking at and making the whole water metaphor as something as what's physically happening in my life.
Brianna, what about for you?
This project has gone above and beyond what I dreamed it would be. Especially last year when we first started the program, we were really approaching people with a series of questions, some writing prompts, and really let them run with it. And I've been so blessed by the stories that have come out of it. I think when we're invited into a space, a safe space to explore our life stories, I think and then we're able to have a critique session, you know, with other writers. There's something really beautiful about that process, and it's been really neat to see, and really humbling to be the artist, you know, walking alongside these stories. And I was thinking about Lisa's painting the other day specifically, because what I love about her writing and the painting paired together is that it really brilliantly weaves together familiar sensations of wading into the ocean and being surprised by the strength of the waves and seeing a gorgeous sunrise that you can't take enough photos of and it still doesn't capture it fully. I think a lot of us have experienced that, you know. But at the same time, it tells a deeply personal narrative. And that's what I love about this project as a whole, is that for the participants themselves, it's this beautiful opportunity to honor their stories. And then for the public, it's an opportunity to dig deeper and to build empathy and awareness for these stories.
Brianna Seipel is an artist, Lisa McCormick is a public speaker, and Kate Knowlton is the interim director of Lotus Legal Clinic. They all spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about the Rise and Thrive, a Lives in Landscape exhibition back when it opened in November. You can see the exhibit in person and socially distanced right now through May 10th. It's over at the Northwestern Mutual Art Gallery on the Cardinal Stritch campus in Fox Point. There's more information at wuwm.com. And that is today's Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for being here with us. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, about her series that is coming up next week for Earth Week. Plus, we'll tell you about Black Space and their mission to provide free therapy to Black, Brown, and LGBTQ people here in Milwaukee. You can hear that all tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR.